This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega. And these are the unmistakable sounds of a family game night favorite.
Six. Over here. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Guys, Jake just landed on Boardwalk, and Ty owns both Boardwalk and Park Place. Oh, Ty is the winner.
Now, that's the YouTube crew, the Williams family, playing Monopoly. From Reading Railroad to St. Charles Place, Boardwalk to Park Place, the goal is to get it all, build it up big, and charge the highest prices. Bragging rights belong to the one who can amass a fortune while bankrupting the siblings.
Oh, yeah, show off all your money.
Okay, yeah.
A little Monopoly with the family and friends is good, clean fun. But real monopolies are big, literally big problems. Back in the 1800s, Americans faced four monopolies, or trusts, that controlled the entire supply of their product. Railroads, oil, steel, and sugar. And with no competition, they could charge high prices without worrying about quality. 19th century lawmakers were not having it and passed a series of antitrust laws to limit the size, scope, and reach of these monopolies. Today, Americans are again facing another big four. This time, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. And some of today's antitrust concerns mirror those of the 19th century, like the problem of limiting competition and stifling innovation in the marketplace. Here's Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal of Washington questioning Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg last July.
Has Facebook ever taken steps to prevent competitors from getting footholds by copying competitors?
And other concerns are a little more 21st century, like the unanswered questions about how these companies collect, analyze, and deploy the data of individual users. Here's Congresswoman Val Demings of Florida questioning Google CEO during the same July 2020 hearing.
Alarm bells were raised about the access to data Google would have, specifically the ability to connect a user's personal identity with their browsing activity.
More than 100 years ago, the U.S. Congress used the Sherman Act, the Clayton Act, and the Federal Trade Commission Act to break up monopolies, halt price fixing, and monitor potential monopolists. Today, the U.S. Congress has prepared six separate pieces of legislation aimed at opening the tech marketplace to more competition and protecting consumers against these giants misusing our data. These are just bills, not yet laws, but the measures do enjoy rare bipartisan support. Still, it's not clear if the legislation can stand up to millions that big tech is spending to lobby against the measures. Last year, Amazon spent $4.4 million and Google spent more than $1.9 million.
Oh, yeah, show off all your money. Okay, yeah.
Joining me now to discuss the possibility of busting up big tech is Alfred Ng, reporter at The Markup. Nice to have you, Alfred.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So these bills came out of a 16-month investigation by the antitrust arm of the House Judiciary Committee. Why did they start the investigation in the first place?
Yeah, so the House Judiciary Committee announced this investigation in June 2019 with a focus on competition in the digital market. There was a concern that a small number of platforms, you know, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and Google had too much power online and were hurting competition.
So talk to me about how they're able to do that with competition. So maybe talk a little bit about the Google search page or how Amazon has used data from its independent sellers.
Yeah, so the results were published in this 400-plus page report in October 2020, listing out all the ways that these four companies had hurt competition have been using their power to stay dominant. And the more important part of the report was how to fix it. But there were issues like Google giving themselves preference in their own search results, and a markup investigation actually found that, you know, about 40% of the search results on a mobile device on the first page were all Google answers. So if you were looking for flight tickets or something like that, instead of other competitors to Google, the first 40% of the page would most likely be Google's own, you know, results. And on Amazon, you know, they had been accused many times, and there had been a lot of companies who said that Amazon does this, where their products were being sold on Amazon, doing very well on Amazon, and then all of a sudden, Amazon comes out with its own product that looked extremely similar to theirs. And Amazon has denied many times that they use their own data that they collect as a platform for this. But, you know, it happens so many times that these companies and are making a fuss about it. And, you know, these laws that have been proposed, one of them has been written to address that exactly.
So let's put this down where the goats can get it. We'll get to the bills in just one second. But for the average user, if I am looking for flight tickets or information about a diagnosis that I've gotten recently on Google, or if I'm trying to find some product and I'm going to Amazon first, what difference does all this make to me?
It makes a big difference because it really limits the choices that you're seeing, right? So a lot of the antitrust laws that were written decades ago were about competition and choices for consumers. And the way that they were structured, it was always around price and quality. And that's not really something you get now. And that's why these laws are written differently, in the sense that it's more about choice than it is about price, right? You're not paying every time you search on Google, or you're not paying anytime you search on Amazon. But now it's more about quality and choices. And if I'm looking for something, now all of a sudden becomes, you know, ads on Amazon or ads on Google that are the top results, rather than something that could potentially be the best choice available for you. So it's hurting you in that sense. And then it's also potentially hurting you by, if Google and Amazon are always the top search results, these competitors that exist might not exist in the long run. And that hurts competition, and quality over time can dwindle because of that.
Okay, let's go through these bills a bit. Three of the six bills, in other words, half of them, are planning to tackle the issue around competition directly. How do they do that?
So yeah, there's three bills that are targeted directly towards mergers and acquisitions. A big part of the report found that there had been hundreds of acquisitions in the last 10 years by these four companies, and many of them went unchallenged. And these bills are trying to change that. So one of them is the Platform Competition and Opportunity Act. That shifts the burden of proving that a merger wouldn't hurt competition to tech giants. The way that it works right now, if there's a merger that's happening, the Department of Justice or the Federal Trade Commission has to challenge these mergers, and then they have to go to court and say, hey, this harms competition. And if they can't prove it, the merger can go through. This bill would flip it the other way around, where these companies now, if they want to buy a company, have to go to court and say, no, the reason why this doesn't hurt competition is X, Y, and Z. And that's a much bigger hurdle for them than it would be for the DOJ to go and prove otherwise.
It's kind of like voter preclearance, the voting rules change preclearance that died in the Supreme Court under Shelby v. Holder. It puts the burden of proof on those who are making that change.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, with the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission, when it comes to regulating the tech companies, is that their resources are very slim. And this is a complaint that I've heard many times from the FTC, that they don't have the same amount of resources to go after big tech that, you know, organizations in the European Union might have. And that's also why the Merger Filing Fee Monetization Act is very important. It's along with changing the fees that are associated with mergers, it also gives a lot more funding to the Department of Justice and the FTC. This bill really takes a look at the fees that are associated with mergers and acquisitions that haven't been updated in more than a decade.
So I want to do one more beat here on the FTC and on this kind of asymmetry of resources, because there's a new FTC chair, right, in our new administration. And boy, some dollars have been spent going after her already. Can you say a few words about that?
Yeah. So the new FTC chair is Lina Khan, who is a very vocal antitrust figure. She is now the head of the FTC, but before that, she was also a big part in this report against these major tech companies. And yes, these companies have really been coming out to get her away from all of this. So Amazon and Facebook have both asked that she be taken off of any of the FTC's antitrust measures, saying that she can't be trusted to be unbiased on this topic because she was so vocal about antitrust in the past.
Now, there are two more bills that go after big data. How do they do that?
Yeah, there's the American Choice and Innovation Online Act, which prevents big companies like Amazon from using the data it gets from third parties that are using its platform for their own market research purposes. So for example, Amazon has been accused many times of, you know, taking the data that it gets as a marketplace and using that data as a products company. So for example, you know, let's say a camera bag is doing really well on Amazon, and Amazon can see this. They see that it's surging to the top of sales. They see that a lot of it's in very high demand. And now they have, they get that data as a platform, and they can turn around and say, well, we're also making this camera bag now. And then all of a sudden, they can also use their own power to put their own camera bag above this one that was doing really well organically, because they own the marketplace as well. And that's also what the American Choice and Innovation Online Act does, where not only can you not use your advantage as a data platform to figure out what's going to sell, you also can't give preference to your own products on your own marketplace.
Now, one last bill, and it has to do with court shopping. What is court shopping, and how does the bill make it harder?
Court shopping is basically whenever a company says, hey, we don't want this trial in this state. Can we do it in another state? Because it would be a lot more convenient for us. So you can actually see a real example of that with Google's case against Texas and a group of other states in a antitrust case. It was based in Texas, or it started in Texas, and Google for months had been arguing, no, we should move this to California. We have more people in California. There's other antitrust cases against us in California. It would be a lot more convenient for everyone if it were in California. Now, the reason why this hurts antitrust cases is because it delays them, it raises the cost, and it can also move a trial away to a state that favors the tech companies more. So in federal antitrust cases by agencies like the FTC or the Justice Department, they actually can't do that. Wherever it's filed, that's where it's supposed to stay. But state attorney generals don't enjoy the same privilege. So the State Antitrust Enforcement Venue Act basically tries to give them the same rights that the FTC and the Justice Department have, where the trial can't be moved and they can't even ask for it to be moved.
Alfred Ng is a reporter with The Markup. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Just a note, The Markup is a nonprofit website, and I serve on its board in a volunteer capacity. It's been nearly 2 weeks since Haitian President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated, throwing the island deeper into a political crisis. Just this morning, Claude Joseph, who has been acting as prime minister and the country's interim leader in the wake of the assassination, has said he will step down and hand power over to his challenger. Ariel Henry will now take up the position. Henry had been appointed prime minister just 2 days before Moïse's assassination, but had yet to be sworn in when the president was assassinated. Now, more than 20 people have been arrested in connection with Moïse's assassination, but there is still many more questions and answers about what happened and what the future holds. The slain president is set to be laid to rest this Friday. For more on this, we turn again to Gary Pierre-Pierre, founder and publisher of the Haitian Times. Gary, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Melissa, for having me.
So clearly, this is a very fluid situation. Situation is changing quite rapidly. What do you know about what's happening here?
Claude Joseph was really never the legal or constitutional prime minister. He had been fired. It was clear. And then to make matters worse is that Henri's appointment had been codified into law because it was published in the Daily government newspaper, which is called Le Moniteur or The Monitor. So basically, according by under Haitian law, once that step is taken, it's legal, it's official. The only thing that was needed to be done was to just have a swearing ceremony, and then Henry would have been prime minister. So when Joseph took over and proclaimed himself still the prime minister, it was not a very smart move. It was rebuffed by everyone, except, of course, the UN representative in Haiti, who, for whatever reason, decided that she was going to legitimize Claude Joseph. But he was never legally the prime minister. And so everybody realized that. And then the core group, as you mentioned, decided, well, absolutely, by law, Henry is the prime minister, so we have to work with him.
Now, say a bit more about what you know about Ariel Henry.
Well, Henry is a former minister of the interior, and he's a respected neurosurgeon. You know, he led the country's health response to the deadly cholera epidemic that Haiti had several years ago. And he's a bureaucrat, a competent one at that. like I said, a physician. So he brings that to the table. Is he a game changer? No. I mean, I think he's going to be a good caretaker for until elections are held. Now, as you know, elections are supposed to be held in September, but no one, you know, thinks that will happen. The most likely scenario is about a year of provisional rule, and then, you know, stabilize the situation on the ground and bring people to the vote. Because one of the things that we haven't focused on for obvious reason is that there is a rising case of COVID in Haiti. And so we have to deal with that situation as well as the other political economic challenges.
It's such a good point. We so frequently hear in American media these days, oh, back during the pandemic, as though it is over. And not only is it not over in the U.S., but the way that the COVID-19 pandemic continues to impact global politics and politics in Haiti that has so little access to the vaccine is absolutely critical.
Absolutely, because cases have been rising as we speak. The country's health infrastructure is as porous or weak as its other institutions. So we've taken our eyes off that right now, but it's still problematic because Haiti just received about 250,000 shipments of vaccines. That sounds like a lot, but the country has about 11 million people, so it's a small fraction of what's needed. And also they need test kits because they charge, in Haiti, you pay $80 to have a COVID test, to take a COVID test. And so the average person does not make that much money in 6 months, let alone to be able to afford to pay for something like that. And, you know, it's necessary. So perhaps the Biden administration should consider sending test kits to Haiti as well, since we have them in abundance right now.
Now, on Sunday, First Lady Moise returned to Haiti after being treated in Miami for wounds that were suffered during the attack. Was that a surprise? And is that going to play into this political situation at all?
Well, it was a huge surprise because at the time, people thought she was in Miami being treated. And then all of a sudden, we have breaking news. She's back. And yes, indeed, that was a political statement because she came back, had a different look. She cut her hair and was wearing nothing but black, of course, and a symbol of mourning. There was a video circulating on social media and across the internet where she came down very gingerly. But when she got to the then Prime Minister Joseph, she gave him a really stern handshake where she really shook his hand hard. So the implicit message saying, I'm back and I'm tough. But at the same time, it was just basically when she came back, not that she came back, because obviously she wanted to bury her husband. Her return has made many people should be worried because she's an eyewitness to what happened. Mm-hmm. She was there. She knew what happened. So the mystery is no longer that much of a mystery because, you know, if she's interviewed by the FBI, she will tell them her version of event or the version of event because, you know, she knew who came into the room, who did what. And so a lot of details will be coming out hopefully this week or so.
Now, on exactly that topic, what do we know right now about the suspects accused in the assassination?
Again, we're not sure. Personally, I'm deeply skeptical of the version, the official version that's been out there. Most of them raise more question than the answer. So, like I said, hopefully we'll have a better idea of what happened. And then those responsible will face justice.
Now, one of those sort of big questions is why no one else was injured. And so the former head of the president's security was placed in detention. What do we know about his potential involvement?
Well, obviously, if you're the head of the security and the asset that you're protecting is dead, then, you know, you have to answer a lot of questions. And the thing about this is that no one was shot or injured or even got a scratch. That's not typical of any security details where the person that you're protecting is dead and then nothing is done. So obviously the first suspect would be someone like that. And then I think they're looking at it. But exactly what his role is, we don't know right now.
Now, last week, you wrote a column for the Haitian Times about what you describe as a caste system and a color-based caste system in Haiti. Can you talk about that just a bit and explain how it's connected to what is happening in the current crisis?
Well, the system in Haiti is that the lighter skin, and I would say a white European Haitian, own 90% of the wealth in Haiti. They are oligarchs. Most of them don't even live in Haiti anymore. They have businesses. And then the more important thing is that the industry that they control, they have their own private ports. And that what that means is that, you know, things come in and go without little government supervision. The gang violence that has engulfed Haiti for the last 2 years, you wonder, well, where are the ammunitions coming from? Because Haiti is under a strict limit on the number of arms and ammunition that it can export and import, rather. And so that raises some question into this social situation. And beyond that, Moïse had begun his battle with them to really call them out and end their monopolies, because they have monopolies and no one else can challenge them. Nobody else can challenge them. They have segmented the city, I mean, the country rather, like a mob cartel would devise a territory. So that system has been in place for well over 100 years, where Black Haitians, and I know that sounds like an oxymoron because most Americans think of Haitians as being Black, but the majority of the Haitian people have been suffered under that system. And so I think, now again, Moïse was not any sort of like hero, and he was corrupted. His presidency was contingent upon making deals with the oligarch. But I think at some point he realized that this was too much. These people, and I think he understood the situation, you know, and as a dark-skinned, you know, person from the peasantry, if you will, who are self-made men. And he realized that this was not fair to the overwhelming majority of Haitians. And he took on a fight that ultimately led to his death.
Hmm. Gary Pierre-Pierre is the founder and publisher of the Haitian Times, and I feel like I'm going to need to have him back to talk more about the response to that last question. Gary, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Lisa.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's been 25 years since the launch of The Daily Show. It's had three hosts, Craig Kilborn, Jon Stewart, and Trevor Noah. And The Daily Show has infiltrated a quarter century of pop culture, satirized five presidential administrations, launched multiple spinoffs, and transformed two generations of young Americans into sarcastic little brats.
The Daily Show. When news breaks, we fix it.
Have you had your picture taken with a Black person yet?
Well, I don't think so.
I see. So scientists are all stupid liars.
White people are, and they call it open carry. For Black people, it's called, he's got a gun!
This was not, as some people seem to believe, another Bush gaffe or malapropism.
Tonight's topic, should medical marijuana be legalized?
Yes.
No.
Yes!
I'm thrilled to be joined by the incomparable Liz Winstead, co-creator of The Daily Show, which will air its reunion special tonight. She's also co-founder of Abortion Access Front. Liz, thank you for being here.
Melissa, it's so great to talk to you.
I have missed you. I loved speaking with you. So talk to me about 25 years ago. Did you figure you were like doing a quick project for the year, or that you were creating an American institution?
Well, you know, I would be kind of a jerk if I was like, you know, I've been hired to create an American institution. I don't think my thoughts are that lofty, but I did know that the country was ripe 25 years ago for some information, because just to set your listeners back to the sort of media landscape that we were living in, there was only CNN. MSNBC was launching shortly after we did, and then Fox News in the fall. So there was CNN, local news, and then there were 17 news magazines that were all over the airwaves. And if you'll remember, during the height of news magazines, it was like just scary stories constantly. Yes. It was like, your mattress, what you don't know, might kill you. So we were sort of taking on the irresponsibility of the news that was going on, and them not actually reporting the news, but sort of scaring us and doing like all of the trials and car chases. And so as the show evolved, it just followed the trends of the media and how the media did its job, helping us understand what was happening to us in our world and what the powerful were doing with the power that they had.
Now, worth noting, it was two women who started this show. Can you talk a little bit about what that meant 25 years ago and what it might still mean right now today?
I mean, yeah, it's always a little disappointing that people, when you tell them two women created The Daily Show, they're always like, what? Really? And it's like, true facts. I know, shockingly, the patriarchy is not saying, let's hear from these women all the time. So I think what it meant was we tried to look at the world through the lens of, you know, who is the most sort of victimized by not getting real information, right? The thing that was a challenge was when you do a news satire, the first thing you have to do is look at the landscape and create something that looks like that landscape. And so that meant filling your position and filling your show full of sort of vapid looking, lantern jawed white men and women who were very perky, and giving them what we did was we created a comedy show that operated like a newsroom, and then wrote text that was not like going in for the joke, but that was prioritizing the banal and elevating it so that folks could understand, like, you know what? They are giving a lot of import to something that is ridiculous, and with the hopes of people would laugh, but also that people would challenge themselves to dig a little bit deeper and not necessarily trust the people who are giving them information.
So let's go back 25 years one more time. Talk to me about the OGs. What were y'all up to? Why did this feel so magical to so many of us watching it?
So that's why we wanted to do this special that's on tonight, was the OGs have never been together in a room to really tell the story of what it was that brought them to the show and how the show actually came to be. And one of the secrets that I'll tell you now, but you have to really watch tonight, is what we did was we tapped into some comedy writers, but mostly we tapped into journalists who were disgruntled by spending thousands of dollars to go to school to actually report stories that mattered, and then found themselves at networks where they're sent out to, you know, cover the OJ trial or cover the Jeffrey Dahmer murder, right? And so there is no one funnier in my experience than a brilliant news reporter who has been subject to not being able to do their job but have to report on trash. So
There should be a lot of geniuses I could name then when it comes to like comedy geniuses relative to that.
You know that. You know how hard you've laughed in newsrooms, Melissa, being there. And so that part was really great. And so when you think about Brian Unger, who was the prototype and the person who really launched the Daily Show correspondent that you know today, you know, we'll be able to hear his stories of what made him decide to leave journalism and come to the Daily Show and how he really helped shape that correspondent, you know. The stories of, we started out with like zero budget because back then cable was a place where you said, I'm willing to take less money because you're going to give me freedom. And the freedom that the network gave us was we didn't have to do a pilot episode, which is a test episode that normally happens in TV. They gave us a year on the air to grow the show, which meant we could really tap into some really brilliant brains and say, if you leave your jobs, you have a year of job security to help make this show great. And so that's really like just the beginning of it. But to hear about A. Whitney Brown, who a lot of people remember from SNL, and why he came on, and Madeline and I, and, you know, Madeline didn't want to do the show. And I was somebody who was desperate to do the show, but she had the production chops and I had the politics and the satire chops. And so as she was making her decision, I was like just praying to the, I don't know what's one prays to, saying, please, Madeline, decide this is important to you. And sure enough, she did. And hence the show was created and born.
25 years later, is the news environment that you were satirizing initially any better?
You know, I think it's better. It's also different. I think anytime that you have, you know, a flood of information, it lends itself to be a place where also then a lot of garbage can collect, right? And so as the media just grew and grew and grew, that meant that it's not just cable and network news, right? It's Twitter, it's online platforms, it's Facebook, it's all of these information aggregates that now also contribute to how The Daily Show satirizes information. And so I think it's news and information that we're looking at as the places that we satirize, not just news anymore.
Is there a way to do satire without being mean?
I think that you've got to really punch up. I think that if your eye is on the prize of taking on the people who have taken power and used it for evil or stupidity, you will always win. If you don't punch down but hold accountable those who could make the world a better place, I think you're going to have a winning strategy.
I like that distinction. You don't punch down, maybe not even lateral, right? You do the accountability piece. Lynn, oh, last thing, what people want to watch, what should they do?
Kevin, it's streaming live on rushtix.com. That's T-I-X, R-U-S-H-T-I-X.com. You can go get tickets. It's also a benefit for Abortion Access Front, which is my nonprofit. So you're going to have some fun and you're going to do some good.
I love it. Liz Winstead, co-creator of The Daily Show. Everyone, check out the 25th reunion special tonight. Thanks so much for joining us, Liz.
Thank you, Melissa.
In February, a series of videos featuring a man who looked a lot like Tom Cruise popped up on TikTok.
What's up, TikTok? You guys cool if I play some sports?
Now, to be clear, that was not actually Tom Cruise. It was a video put together by a special effects professional that starred a Cruise impersonator. But for people just scrolling through TikTok, how are they supposed to know that the footage was actually what's known as a deep fake? Now, in recent years, deepfake videos have become increasingly convincing. But in many of those videos, the audio has felt, well, fake. Then last week, a debate was ignited about the ethics of using artificial intelligence to create convincing audio that a person never actually said. New Yorker writer Helen Rosner published an article revealing that for the new documentary Roadrunner, filmmaker Morgan Neville had used AI technology to create audio simulating the voice of the late Anthony Bourdain reading an email that he wrote to a friend. The decision was sharply criticized by many on social media, particularly because viewers of the film would not have known that the audio was manipulated if Neville hadn't disclosed the fact during his interview. In response to Rosner's initial questions, Neville said, quote, "We can have a documentary ethics panel about it later," end quote. Well, I'm kind of thinking maybe we should have an ethics panel now. I mean, audio manipulation isn't exactly new. Remember the year that the tearjerker track of the late Nat King Cole posthumously singing a duet with his daughter Natalie?
That's why, darling, it's incredible that someone so unforgettable thinks that I am unforgettable too.
When the departed Nat King Cole harmonizes with a beloved daughter, I get butterflies in my stomach. But when the voice of departed Anthony Bourdain is chopped and spliced to make him speak words he never spoke, well, I get a little queasy in my stomach. So what are the ethics of audio? And what responsibilities do creators have when presenting this work to the public? Here to help me answer that question is Karen Howe, senior AI editor at the MIT Technology Review. Great to have you here, Karen.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
So before we get to the ethics, can you explain to me how this kind of AI works?
Yes. So you brought up some great examples of deepfakes, both video and audio. And deepfake is just, it's a very broad category of synthesized media that is specifically generated by artificial intelligence. So back in the day, if you wanted to touch up a video, if you wanted to touch up a photo, or touch up some audio, you're manually editing things in Photoshop or You're manually mixing the sound to try and tweak and tune different elements of it to make it sound more like someone or to make it look more like someone. And it's a very laborious process, and you need a significant amount of training and be a professional in that space to achieve that kind of high quality effect. But with AI technology today, you can essentially just take thousands and thousands of audio clips of someone's voice or thousands and thousands of photos of that person's face, feed it into an algorithm. The algorithm learns what makes someone look Melissa-ish or sound Melissa-ish, and then it will start pumping out new pictures, new videos, or new audio that really captures the likeness of that person, to the point where today it's really hard to detect sometimes if the what you're seeing or what you're hearing is actually real or fake.
So that's a fascinating technology. And I could see how it could be valuable if we had informed consent, if we had a living subject who said, all right, I wrote this as an email, you know, I've never actually said it, but sure, you know, take time to use the AI to make that voice. I could even imagine for some folks who lose their voice related to disease or disability, that it's a way to produce a voice, you know, of them that sounds closer to their own voice before it's lost. But it feels really different when someone can't give consent for it.
I think you touch on one of the core ethical challenges here. I think there's sort of two that come into play when we're talking about the Bourdain example. One is consent. Obviously, this was done posthumously. And there's a question of, okay, well, did he really want to portray himself that way? Sure, he wrote that email. Those are his words. But in the same way that a writer might write a piece of fiction, and then they have a particular vision in their mind for how that would be presented, it feels a little weird that someone just took creative license to present his words in the way that they wanted, not the way that he wanted. And I feel like the second issue is disclosure. So the public was feeling really riled up, in part because they would have never found out that this was fake audio unless Helen Rosner had actually asked Melville how he actually obtained the audio of the email. And then it came out through the interview that he had used this synthetic method. And so because we're treading very new territory here, there are very few examples of this technology being used in mainstream media production. I think we're just starting to learn how much people can really care about the consent of a person and the disclosure to the audience, like those two elements.
And I keep thinking there is a political possibility here. I mean, if I could just make, you know, former President Trump or current President Joe Biden say anything because I've got plenty of audio to feed into my algorithm, that strikes me as really dangerous.
Absolutely. I think that is one of the most terrifying aspects of deepfakes. There's definitely a very big worry that even if we have these technologies developed by companies that are responsible, that will only take on certain projects after they've vetted it for ethics, the technology already exists out there and anyone can use it at any time. And that means bad actors as well. And there's both a concern of misinformation, political misinformation, where we see or hear video and audio of a politician saying something, believe that it's true and it's actually completely fake. And there's also the flip concern that we see something that's completely real, but because this technology exists, we now start to doubt its veracity and believe that it might be fake. And this was really interesting because I don't know if people remember when the Hollywood Access tape came out, probably like a few months after that came out, Trump actually said, oh, well, these days there are so many like fake voice technologies out there now. And he tried to evoke the idea that it might have been synthesized. So both of those situations are rather dangerous because they sort of slowly erode away our trust of media.
All right, Karen, I want you to just take a minute and listen to something that the crew and I came up with this morning. Baby girl, what's your name? Well, I'm Melissa Harris Perry. Listen, wait, I don't think this is the time. You know me. Okay, T, that's all good, but right now I'm guest hosting The Takeaway. Look, we're all just having a little fun here with T T-Pain's 2008 smash hit, Buy You a Drink. And as part of the Netflix series, This Is Pop, T-Pain revealed suffering years of depression after an encounter with the pop singer Usher, who claimed that because T-Pain makes use of the pitch correction software Auto-Tune,
he's like, man, you kind of f***ed up music.
So, Karen, you know, we were just talking about this notion of plausible deniability or realism. And I know it seems kind of odd, but I want to go to the T-Pain auto-tune for a moment, because part of what happens with T-Pain is he turns auto-tune up so much that you know there's a distortion happening. But so much of how auto-tune is actually used is to make us believe that what we're hearing is someone singing in pitch when in fact they're not.
This is such a great example. I haven't actually thought about that's true. Like, the fact that we're synthesizing audio today is sort of like an extension of many of the editing technologies, audio technologies that we've had before. I kind of want to go back to images as an analog, because when deepfakes first came out, people thought, oh my gosh, now that we have these synthetic faces that look identical to the original person, this is a completely new technology that we've never seen before. And then a lot of experts came and said, actually, no, we've had Photoshop. And there are similar ethical questions around Photoshop. It's just that because it's a more familiar technology to us and to the public, we now have general guidelines for understanding how to Photoshop images in a way that doesn't mislead or doesn't completely falsify certain things. And I think it's the same thing with like auto-tune and deepfake voice technology now, where auto-tune was sort of the predecessor, where we were just beginning to play with this stuff. But the distinction that you made is very real, which is that both Photoshop and auto-tune, there is still a certain element of detection, or there, because the public is aware of these things, they know to look out for it. And with deep fakes, not only do people not really know that this technology exists right now, it's also so much harder to actually figure out whether or not it's been used. And so there's like a completely different set of norms that we're going to have to start developing for filmmakers or musicians or whatever, to figure out what is the actual responsible way of disclosing this to the public.
You know, I so appreciate the language you're using of norms, of guidelines, because this doesn't particularly feel to me like the kind of thing that can be legislated, at least not yet, right? This is a swiftly moving technology, and this is really about those folks who have what is, in fact, a pretty incredible power with audio. How do norms arise when we think about something like artificial intelligence and how it gets used in media spaces?
I feel like the way, because AI moves so fast, the norms really do arise by just trial and error. So, you know, in this example, Melville kind of trialed something, and then clearly the public did not take it well. And now we know that there's probably some norm that was crossed, and we should refine what that boundary is. But there's an interesting example of deepfakes being used in a different documentary, and this time it was deepfake faces, not voice. And it was the 2020 documentary called Welcome to Chechnya, and it's about these LGBTQ activists in Chechnya that are trying to push for human rights and hold the government accountable to human rights abuses against the queer community. And the documentary filmmaker wanted to tell these people stories, but was caught in this moral dilemma, because if he showed their faces, they could be at risk of being killed for their work. And so he used deepfake faces to actually change their face, but it still retained their emotional expressiveness. It still retained the authenticity of their day-to-day real life experiences. And what he did was he kind of left a little bit of a halo or glowing effect around the people whose faces were altered. And also, I believe, said in the beginning of the documentary, a disclosure that most of the characters in the film were speaking with faces that were not their own. And in that case, it was very widely celebrated. So again, he trialed something, and now it did go well. So we now understand, okay, this might be a possible solution moving forward for other filmmakers who are trying to experiment with the same technology. So I think we're still at such a nascent stage that it's really just about, trialing responsibly, but and talking with different people, different stakeholders, to make sure that you understand sort of what the different questions or different concerns that will arise every time you use the technology.
It may be nascent, but I do feel like you're beginning to map for us some key issues, right? Disclosure, consent, purpose of the use, right? Is it for a creative license, right? Or is it to advance something that is problematic or nefarious, right? And then also this language of like collaboration, right? That it's not a decision an individual makes, but one that is made as part of a sort of an open process. I feel like all of that is a useful way for us thinking about audio ethics more broadly, whether it's about pop music or documentaries or what we do on the radio every day.
Absolutely. I think one of the things when you engage with such new technologies is you need to be attentive to like the different conversations that are happening in the public and in expert communities who have been studying these technologies or interacting with these technologies for a while. So this is certainly a nascent technology in the sense that we've never really had deepfake audio that has achieved such high quality and been used in a mainstream setting. It's not emerging in the sense that there have been experts studying this for several years now, and there are certain previous examples that can be used as analogs to understand, okay, this time around, even if the technology has advanced even more, what can we learn from the ethics of autotune? What can we learn from other audio editing projects that didn't necessarily use AI, but sort of achieve the same effect? And through engaging in a lot of that discourse, that's sort of how you can make decisions with more wherewithal, I suppose, instead of just like secretly making it yourself and then announcing it to the world and hoping that people take it well.
Karen Howe is the senior AI editor at the MIT Technology Review. Karen, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
And folks, we want to hear from you on this. How do you feel about the emergence of artificial intelligence to doctor audio, video, photo? What concerns do you have? Tell us by recording a voice message. No, really, you record it in your voice and send it to the takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Again, takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Well, that's the show, and I don't know about you, but the music's got me hyped for Monday. If you have any show ideas or suggestions, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.